Hello, I'm Peter Howarth. I'm Global Clinical Scientific Lead at GSK, and it's my great pleasure today to welcome you to this non-promotional, non-CME disease state educational podcast brought to you by EARCHI in collaboration with and paid for by GlaxoSmithKline. The topic we're going to discuss today is differentiation of HES and EGPA diagnosis. And I'm really delighted to have two very eminent experts in this field with me to discuss this topic. I have Dr. Florence Rufos from the Hospital Erasme in Brussels, Belgium, and Dr. Maria Cid from the Hospital Clinic, University of Barcelona in Spain. They will help discuss with me the challenges that clinicians face in differentiating HES and EGPA, and the importance of proper and prompt diagnosis for these rare conditions. Let me start by a general question. Dr. Rufos, in your clinical practice, how common are patients with EGPA and HES?
So first of all, I think it's important to say that my practice is probably not representative of all practices. I have a tertiary care referral center for hypereosinophilia. So as such, I do get enriched referrals for EGPA and HES. So in my experience, I would say that among patients who are referred to me with hypereosinophilia for a final diagnosis, perhaps 20% of patients will eventually receive a diagnosis of HES or EGPA. This has also been reviewed in the literature. There are several interesting literature reviews with tertiary care centers, secondary care centers. And as you go down in terms of the level of referral centers, the proportion of patients who actually have EGPA or HES obviously decreases progressively. And for example, there was a very, very nice study on more than 350 patients that was published very recently showing that in a secondary care setting where patients are referred for hypereosinophilia, roughly 5 to 10% of patients will receive a diagnosis of HES. And if we're really in the primary care setting, we are well below 5%, obviously.
Yes, no, it's readily recognizable that these are rare conditions, and obviously running a specialist service will enrich your experience with this. So, Dr. Cid, in your practice in Spain, what are the key symptoms that patients with HES or EGPA may present to you with?
Usually, and the main symptoms are a little bit different between both diseases. I would say that EGPA patients present with constitutional symptoms sometimes, but this is variable among patients. Then usually they have past history and present history of asthma and ENT symptoms. And then on top of that, they develop evidence of systemic organ involvement that usually affects the lungs, the skin, the peripheral nervous system, the GI tract, etc. For the hypereosinophilic syndrome, my experience is probably more limited because it's in our environment even a more rare disease, at least in my setting, which can be biased as well because of referral. But I would say that the cases we have diagnosed are somehow more indolent in appearance. They have skin involvement. Most of them, some of them had myositis, eosinophilic myositis, CNS involvement, or cardiac involvement. So these are the presenting symptoms in my experience. We have seen like about 50 patients with EGPA and maybe a dozen with hypereosinophilic syndrome.
So Dr. Rufos, obviously these patients can present in a multiple different ways and to perhaps to different specialists before they get referred through. What are the challenges in differentiating HES from EGPA?
I would say that the main challenge is due to the fact that EGPA in its most common presentation evolves in several phases. And so there's the so-called prodromal asthmatic phase. And then the patients developed a kind of hypereosinophilic syndrome with eosinophilic infiltrates, blood hypereosinophilia, and then only then do they actually develop vasculitis. And the time frame that separates the appearance of adult onset asthma and the development of vasculitis is very variable, but it can be somewhere between 5 and 10 years. So it's really when patients reach that second phase, they're practically indistinguishable from patients who have hypereosinophilic syndrome, especially if at that moment in time, they do not have positive ANCA and they do not have positive antibodies, specific antibodies like anti-myeloperoxidase. That is very, very challenging. One hint to differentiate the two, but it's very limited, it's imperfect, is the fact that asthma is almost invariably the presenting symptom in patients with EGPA. And it's typically adult onset asthma. As the years advance, it gets more and more difficult to control. The exacerbations are more and more common. Patients require more and more systemic corticosteroid courses over time. And also, this is frequently associated with chronic sinus disease. That being said, this type of manifestation can be present in hypereosinophilic syndrome as well. And it's well known that the lungs are affected in a significant proportion of patients. The proportions are different from one study to the next, but it's roughly 40% of patients with HES who have lung manifestations. And among these lung manifestations, asthma is now a recognized clinical manifestation of HES. So I think it's really HES patients who have predominant pulmonary symptoms versus ANCA-negative EGPA patients who are in that prodromal phase, which is preparing the development of vasculitis, but before vasculitis has developed. Once patients develop complete clinical picture with very frank vasculitic manifestations, once again, the differential diagnosis becomes more straightforward.
Oh, thank you. That's a helpful insight. So, Dr. Sid, in your practice, are there any particular key diagnostic features or biomarkers that you would normally apply that might help you understand these patients and perhaps differentiate EGPA from HES?
Based on the clinical appearance, sometimes, as Professor Rufos said, times they are quite different, but sometimes it may be difficult to distinguish between both disease because sometimes asthma can be very mild or in the past history for EGPA. And sometimes HES patients may complain of dyspnea, etc. Regarding biomarkers, ANCA is very useful because ANCA testing actually is associated with EGPA. Another biomarker important could be the histological demonstration of necrotizing vasculitis, which is not always possible. Patients with HES may have a perivascular eosinophil infiltration, but not fully developed necrotizing vasculitis. Therefore, if you in a biopsy find a glomerulonephritis, which is a type of small vessel vasculitis, or you have necrotizing vasculitis, these highly support the diagnosis of EGPA. In cases without this tissue or serum biomarkers, sometimes can be more difficult than the distinguishing between HES and EGPA. Actually, some patients may fulfill diagnostic criteria used in trials for HES or for EGPA, depending on how strongly you consider certain features.
I recognize that sometimes it can be very difficult to distinguish these conditions, and there is substantial overlap. Do you see cardiac disease as commonly in HES as you see in EGPA?
In EGPA, cardiac disease, clinically significant cardiac disease, we see that not much often. Actually, I would say that in our series that is about 50 patients, we have seen pleural effusion. We have seen intracardiac thrombus in one patient, but then clinically relevant, less than 5%. Yeah. In our particular experience, it can be more frequent in other European referral centers. But in our environment, cardiac involvement in EGPA clinically relevant is not very frequent. It looks like that if you perform systematic screening, you may have MRI findings suggesting some involvement. But this is not known whether this would require more intensive treatment if it's not clinically relevant. We have seen also myocardial infarction in one patient, in two patients actually, yeah.
Yes. So Dr. Rufos, would you routinely do cardiac assessment in your patients? And, you know, are there other tests that you do that might help you distinguish other diseases with symptoms that might mimic HES or EGPA?
So those are two separate questions. To answer the first one, yes, I would definitely do a systematic evaluation of the heart in patients with hypereosinophilic syndrome, even if, as Professor Sid said, sometimes we are overly sensitive with what we do. With cardiac MRI does show sometimes some very, very subtle changes that have no clinical impact, but we certainly take them into account when we're treating the patient, because someone who seems to have something happening in the heart using cardiac MRI, we will probably be more tight in terms of control of the hypereosinophilia. So we definitely look for cardiac complications in patients with HES, and I would say all the more so if the decision is to either not treat or treat lightly and suboptimally. Cardiac follow-up is particularly important because the first stages of heart involvement in HES are asymptomatic. And once cardiac involvement progresses, the type of lesions that develop, and we'll certainly talk about that later on, become irreversible. So it's important to have an early detection of these complications, and it can be a prompt to treat patients a bit more aggressively. To answer the second question, which was regarding other diseases which might have to be distinguished from HES and EGPA, and I imagine that you are thinking more particularly about diseases that present with a predominant lung involvement, there are indeed several different disorders that have to be distinguished. There's the ABPA, so when there's a, let's say, sensitization to aspergillosis, aspergillitis fumigatis in general, and this can also present with hypereosinophilia. Generally, patients have very elevated serum IgE levels as well. They have lung infiltrates, some of which have pretty characteristic semiology in terms of imaging studies, and this is a disease that has to be distinguished from HES and EGPA. Chronic eosinophilic pneumonia, does it have to be distinguished from HES or not? Is it part of the HES disease spectrum or not? That's really a question of classification and how different centers choose to classify these disorders. But I consider that patients with chronic eosinophilic pneumonia have a form of organ-restricted hypereosinophilic syndrome, but it often has a particular way of evolving, a particular disease course where complications only repeatedly occur in the lungs. And these patients are certainly less of a concern in terms of development of cardiac complications. So it's also useful to be able to think of this differential diagnosis and take that into account in terms of patient management. And then there's, of course, a series of secondary causes of pulmonary hypereosinophilia. You can have pulmonary hypereosinophilia in parasitic infections when the larvae mature in the pulmonary circulation and tissue with a Loeffler type syndrome. There's also paraneoplastic hypereosinophilia that can manifest in the lungs. Some drug allergies are limited in terms of clinical expression to pulmonary hypersensitivities. Yes, there's a series of differential diagnoses for eosinophilic lung disorders that have to be taken into account when trying to make a differential diagnosis.
Thank you. There's obviously quite a number of things to think about and consider. Sid, we heard earlier on from Dr. Rufos that patients may have a prodromal period with EGPA when they have asthma and perhaps sinus disease, but there may be a period of 5 to 10 years before the vasculitic features of the disease manifest themselves, which makes it difficult to sometimes consider a diagnosis of EGPA. It may be overlooked. And I wonder if you could discuss, you know, as a general advice to physicians who might be listening, how to be aware of the disease and, you know, what approaches might they take to increase their awareness and consideration that there might be an underlying EGPA condition.
I must say that these three phases that are classically considered in EGPA in many patients occur over a long period of time, as you mentioned, but other patients develop quite quickly, so it's highly variable. But certainly for a substantial proportion of patients, they complain for a long period of time before developing vasculitis or systemic disease. They complain from asthma and sinusitis or rhinitis. So actually, I would say that some patients are referred to us with only these symptoms because they have, you know, more eosinophilia than you would expect for asthma. And sometimes the patients just stay there. And probably if you ask pulmonologists, they will see more, a higher amount of these patients that are really over EGPA. So some patients never progress beyond asthma or sinus or rhinitis involvement. So it's for physicians taking care of these patients, it would be important that when they consider just the disease and when they see the patient, just do a quick survey of potential systemic disorders of if the patient develop constitutional symptoms or other manifestations that may lead to the suspicion of a systemic disease.
Yes, I think you highlight there that it's obviously very important for clinicians looking after patients to have measures of blood eosinophil counts, and that might be a marker that alerts people to the condition. And I wonder, Dr. Rufos, is there a threshold level for blood eosinophils that you would recommend physicians, clinicians, healthcare professionals to take account of, to refer on for further assessment, to think about HES and for EGPA?
Yes, well, typically the threshold that is used and that has been used for ages now is 1,500 per millimeter cube or 1.5 giga per liter. That certainly has to alert clinicians to do a proper investigation, both for the causes and consequences of hypereosinophilia. That being said, with the newer definitions of what a hypereosinophilic syndrome is, that can also somehow include tissue hypereosinophilia. And when massive tissue hypereosinophilia is present, or hypereosinophilia that is considered abnormal for a given tissue, then we tolerate lesser levels in the blood and consider that this is very similar in terms of pathogenesis. So the other threshold that can be seen regularly is more than 1 giga per liter. Whatever the threshold that's used, I think the important part is being very attentive to the existence of clinical disease manifestations plus an increased eosinophil count in the blood, generally above 1 giga per liter, and in investigating that intensively and trying to have as much as possible histological evidence for tissue involvement by this hypereosinophilia.
Well, thank you very much. I think that's a clear clinical guidance point to end on, that the presence of eosinophil count above that level should initiate some thoughts about referral for more detailed assessment. And because of the varying manifestations and the different time courses of presentation, that diseases such as EGPA and HES may get overlooked and may be difficult to define. Dr. Rufos and Dr. Sid, I perhaps will end there and thank you very much indeed for your valuable discussion today about this rare situation of patients with HES and EGPA and the difficulties that one might have in differentiating the two conditions. Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you.